Klein. Welcome to the July 31st meeting of the Portland City Council. Carla, would you please call the roll?
Saltzman, Novick,
here.
Fritz,
here.
Fish, Hales,
here. Well, welcome, everyone. We have two items on the council calendar this afternoon. One is slated to start at 2 p.m. and the other at 2:45. It's our plan to start the 2 p.m. item, which is the Historic Landmarks Commission work, and then interrupt at 2:45 to take the Design Commission's report. So bear with us while we make both of those happen this afternoon. For those of you who are not frequent visitors here, welcome. And we simply ask that if you testify, that you sign up and let us know that you want to speak on an item. You don't need to give your full name and address, just your name. We typically allow 3 minutes per person unless we have a huge number of people signed up to testify. And I think we have a large number, but not huge, so we'll stick with that. If you agree with somebody and want to demonstrate that, feel free to wave your hand or something, but we ask that we not have vocal demonstrations for or against our fellow citizens while they're having their say. So please respect that rule of decorum so that everybody feels safe to say what they feel. And if you're a lobbyist representing an organization, please let us know that. So with that, why don't you read the first item, please, Carla?
Item 805, accept the Portland Historic Landmarks Commission State of the City Preservation Report.
Commissioner Fritz.
Thank you, Mayor Hales. It is absolutely my honor to bring this report presented by the Historic Landmarks Commission. And with those who are presenting, please come forward as I'm making some opening remarks. The Historic Landmarks Commission works with the City Council and the Bureau of Development Services to help preserve and tell the story of our city. Our homes, office buildings, and parks, our physical environment, they provide daily reminders of our city's history and architectural heritage. I have a little bit more strong of a British accent right now because I was just back in England for 3 weeks visiting my mother, and historic buildings are something that they have a lot of there. In fact, they wouldn't even consider this particular building particularly old by their standards, but I certainly feel very joyful every morning when I come into work that I get to work in a historic building and respect the work that's been done in this building to restore it to its initial glory. So I very much appreciate the work of the volunteers on the Landmarks Commission. And it's very important to recognize that they are volunteers and citizens who are actively engaged in giving us advice and doing enormous volume of wonderful work on how to maintain the character of our neighborhoods and how to prioritize the goals such as the updating of the historic resources inventory and how to protect the precious buildings that we have and while still respecting the rights of property owners and neighbors simultaneously. So it's not easy work, and it's very much my honor to have the Historic Landmarks Commission present this report. While they're getting settled, I'll just read off the names of the folks who are on the commission. Brian Emmerich, Jessica Engerman, Harris Matarazzo, Paul Solimanaro, I should have had you do this, Karen Carlson, Kirk Ranzetta, and Carolyn Dow.
Welcome.
Thank you, guys. Thank you so much for having us. I think this is our fifth annual address to you guys. And again, I'm Brian Emmerich, chair of the Landmarks Commission, and architect. Does a lot of adaptive reuse and historic, so that's kind of my background. To my right is Jessica Engerman, our vice chair, and she works for Venable Properties, who's known kind of historic developer, so we kind of look at things from that lens. Again, there's seven members on the commission. We've got an archaeologist, a historian, a lawyer, so we're a pretty diverse group. Gives us a lot of resources to pull from. And I think that that's been one of the amazing things that we've gotten to see over the years, as me personally, is just how many dedicated volunteers we actually have in the city. It's amazing how many people come and testify and speak in front of us and share their knowledge with the city. So one of my favorite quotes actually is on Portland's oldest piece of public art, which is the Skidmore Fountain. And it says, good citizens are the riches of a city. So, and I think that's really been the genesis of why this is such a great livable place. And we're proud and honored to carry that tradition forward. So I wanted to share first, a few accomplishments we had over the last year, and then we're going to present our kind of top five priorities for the next year coming up, and we'll kind of co-present those as we go through that. But last year was a great year in that we worked closely with City Council to achieve the historic resource code improvement package, and I'm happy to come here today and say that's been extremely successful. So, yeah, we've had 87 cases come forward in the first year, saving about $87,000 for private homeowners in those, and greatly expediting the process so that being in a historic district for minor modifications is no longer a kind of a punitive thing. Mm-hmm. And you guys helped us work really closely to get that fee down to only $250. And I know that took some coordination with Bureau of Development Services and Bureau of Planning and Sustainability. So it's great. I just want to let you know that's working, and we really appreciated council support in getting that done. We also worked closely with the West Quadrant planning process over the last year. Actually, it's been 18 months, and we've attended every one of those sessions, and we're excited about the plan going forward and the 2035 plan as well. I think we've got some goals and priorities that are tied in with that we'll talk in more detail about, but just want to let you know we've been participating in that and excited about the new plans coming forward. I think also we've gotten a more successful collaboration with public agencies, and that's coming to fruition over the last year or two, actually, with both Portland Development Commission and Council's support for having a liaison there. We met with Patrick Quinton, and Ed McNamara was there as well, and getting some good progress and communication there on both sides. Jessica will talk a little bit more about that. And also have had good communications with the Portland Water Bureau. We're working on a big project, or they are, to replace the historic reservoirs up in Washington Park. So that's been good, productive. And I think, you know, we're chipping away at the historic resource index that you mentioned, Amanda. So that's a big project coming forward, and that's one of our specific priorities. So I'll let Jessica talk more about that when we get to that. But we did use our certified local grant funds last year to kind of take a crack at that a little bit in conjunction with the seismic study, so which is one of our priorities. So I'm going to jump in. First, I also wanted to thank staff. I mean, the staff's great, and we can't do our work without staff. So your support, Amanda, because they're in your Bureau of Staff Hours and Resources, is just really huge for us. So I want to take a minute to thank them. And yeah, so I would say, you know, our first priority in here is design guidelines. And what that is basically we have 15 designated historic districts. Most of them have design guidelines, but actually a number of them don't. And they're almost all really outdated. Most of them date to the 1980s. And we really want to get those up to speed going forward, because right now we're in a time where, you know, we're seeing both the economy coming back and land values rising and this kind of increase in density. And we want to make sure that as we invest in our communities, especially our historic districts, those are some of our most important communities, that we're really crafting those with a careful vision. Our number one priority is getting Skidmore Old Town design guidelines implemented. We've been talking about that for a few years now. Those date back to about 2008, and they're really close. They really just need some polishing, and I think they're ready to put into play. So we've talked about that at the West Quadrant Strategic Advisory Committee and gotten support from that group. It's actually in the top priority list in the next year. The outcome of that was they want to see those get implemented. So that's a big one, and we're going to need council support, obviously, to get that passed.
So are they ready to come back, or do you need to polish them up, as you said? Is there a little more work that needs to be done in the community before the council would hear them?
I think because, Amanda, they're from 2008, it would be wise to take another quick look at them and make sure that we feel like they still represent what we want today, since there's been a number of years that have elapsed. But what we want to be careful about, obviously, is, you know, we invested over $100,000 in time and public process to get them to that point and to the point where they're ready for adoption. We don't want to open Pandora's box, so to speak, and redo the whole thing, because I think we feel like they're a great benchmark and they're ready to go. But I think it would be appropriate probably to have one more round of just kind of input, essentially, at the landmarks level.
Commission, yeah.
I'm very supportive of that.
Yeah, me too.
Great. We loved hearing that. So, and you know,
excuse me. Can I ask a really naive question?
Yeah.
How do you operate in an historic district if there aren't design guidelines? You have to sort of generally be historic?
That's a great question, Steve. So like in districts like Chinatown, for instance, there are no design guidelines, even though that's one of our more recognizable historic districts. And so they default to the central city guidelines, which are not very specific. And And a lot of people think, and that's a, kind of the next point, but a lot of people think, like, say, Skidmore Old Town and Chinatown are the same, but they're actually two independent historic districts, and they have different characters, and so we really want to pull out, like, Skidmore Old Town, for instance, is one of the, it's like the second largest cast iron collection outside of Soho, New York, so it's really important for that, and the design characteristics and guidelines are weighted heavily toward those elements of the neighborhood versus Chinatown, of course, has the Asian and Japan history there and a different kind of build quality and context. So different guidelines for there make sense. And, you know, that's really a top priority for us as well, because working with PDC, you know, we're super excited about this 5-year action plan that they've brought to council with $57 million invested over the next 5 years. And we're totally pro-development on the landmark side. So in appropriate ways, but we have no design guidelines for Chinatown, so we're really concerned that, you know, we're getting the cart a little bit before the horse, and we want to prioritize getting design guidelines in play for that, both from, you know, working in experience with private development, knowing that developers want certainty coming forward and not to have those kind of dialogues at a submittal level, but actually beforehand, so that we've got a good clear path of where we want to go as a community before we, you know, get too deep into that investment. But we're really excited about that action plan, though.
As you mentioned, the commission put in an enormous amount of work on the Skidmore design standards. So with the mayor's agreement, it seems to me that if you could get that to us before you start work on the Old Town Chinatown, so that we can, you know, check one off. They are different.
Yeah.
They have different standards. So I think we're both very interested in having that come soon.
Yeah. Great. Well, and we're hoping to be able to streamline the process a little bit, not in terms of public involvement, but in terms of kind of crafting the benchmark, which we've done, we feel, with the Skidmore Old Town, and be able to reuse that as a template, essentially, for the Chinatown, because we're going to need your support, I think, to be able to generate funds to do that. Last time, like I mentioned, I think it was around $100,000 to do the Skidmore Old Town design guidelines, which, you know, in the context of a $57 million public investment, that's not a lot relative to that, so we want to make sure, but the money's going to have to come from somewhere. So we want to make sure that that's identified as a priority and kind of gets that ball rolling. And then, you know, looking out in the future, I think we would take those as next tier. So on the other districts, we really want to prioritize those first two at this point. So I'm going to let Jessica talk a little bit on the next point, which is update our historic resource inventory.
Right. And it sounds like you're familiar with this. It's been on our report for probably every year that we've presented so far, and we continue to place a very high priority on updating a comprehensive citywide survey. This was first done in the mid-1980s and really hasn't been touched since then. And for the benefit of everyone in the room who may not be familiar with historic surveys and what they mean and why they're important, survey data provides baseline information on potential historic resources to inform our planning decisions and to support our policy goals. So later on, when Brian talks about Priority 5, which is related to neighborhood preservation and some of the issues that we're facing around demolition right now, this really drives home the need for the updated HRI, projected population growth, the increased density, the healthy real estate market all mean that strain on historic resources will continue, and it's more important than ever right now to know what we have, where it's located, why it's important, and so that we can decide what it is we want to save and protect. I'll mention that Portland is trailing behind cities like Los Angeles and Seattle, Detroit, even smaller towns like Bellingham, Washington, that are currently or have recently been investing money in surveying their building stock to identify historic resources. And certainly that doesn't mean that we're too late. We can catch up. And as Brian mentioned, in recent years, the Landmarks Commission has supported the use of matching grant funds to help chip away, to fund modest efforts at identifying historic resources. And these have been very issue-specific, kind of like the seismic report that I'll be talking about next. And so while these have been very worthwhile small steps, we really feel it's time, now is the right time to make a bigger move and address the critical need of a citywide survey. So this year in our report, we've laid out a general strategy to how we might accomplish this over several years, and we've identified ways that we might minimize costs. We're very fortunate on the Landmarks Commission that we have experts in field data collection, that we have one of the foremost experts in the state, probably the region, on historic surveys. So we feel that we can craft a strong path and get to our end goal. So I'm not going to...
Commissioner
Ranzetta. Yes, that's Commissioner Ranzetta. I won't go into the specific details of our strategy, but I do want to emphasize that the Landmarks Commission feels it's important to base our survey priorities on those priorities that were already identified in the revised Portland plan, that we would want to harness neighborhood resources, volunteers, and the current strong climate of neighborhood interest in protecting historic resources, and that it's also important to instill predictability in the preservation planning process by having the survey be a city-managed initiative. So with that, we are asking council to consider a $20,000 from the general fund to initiate a single neighborhood survey in 2015, and this would be our pilot project from which we could build a larger neighborhood-by-neighborhood survey that would be undertaken in phases between 2016 and 2020.
How would you choose the pilot neighborhood, or have you already done so?
We haven't, and I'm...
Where do you live? No.
There's nothing historic. It was one house.
You might be surprised. No, we haven't decided that yet. We'd probably try to pick something that either overlaps like we did with the masonry study so that we're getting more bang for our buck out of that, or is, we think, a particularly representative area, you know, of, that's generic enough that we could use to extrapolate data from. Yeah.
Well, and you have made this request, I think, every year that I've been on the council.
Yes.
So, and in past years, 20,000 was an enormous amount that we simply weren't able to find once we were making cuts. At this time, 20,000 seems quite reasonable, so I hope that we would be able to find a way to do that.
Yeah, we would really appreciate that. And I think we're just realizing that there's just so many different ways to collect data now and stuff, like through Portland Maps and other data indexes, that it actually may not be as big of a task as we once thought it was if we can manage how we get the information. So,
thank you.
So moving on to priority three, which is related to seismic upgrades. Last year, we used our CLG funds to support a study that was issued to study unreinforced masonry buildings on the east side of the river. And this was targeted in neighborhoods such as Foster Lentz, Northeast Sandy, Montevilla, Westmoreland, St. John's, and a few others. And the goal was to understand the unique conditions and constraints related to our smaller scale URM, that's unreinforced masonry buildings, in neighborhood commercial corridors, and how well city policy is working to encourage upgrades. The findings from the study showed that in historic cores of these neighborhoods, very few URM buildings are actually being upgraded, and we feel this lack of upgrades that's happening outside the central city where we have larger URM buildings is still a key and important issue. A factor that actually doesn't seem to be very well understood is that many vintage buildings, which were originally built for commercial use, were downgraded in their occupancy hazard classification during the period of urban flight. So now that our urban commercial corridors are coming back, they're being revitalized, these buildings are actually at a disadvantage with their occupancy rating that might be storage, for instance. And this does not allow the easy adaptive reuse for active uses without triggering seismic upgrades. Speaking from personal experience working in development, I can say that the economics to upgrade these buildings is difficult and often does not make sense based on their income potential, because we have a market where tenants are not demanding seismically upgraded buildings and they are not willing to pay a premium and above market rate. So certainly not every URM building is historic and worth saving, but there are many URM buildings outside the central city that are historically significant and are important to the fabric of our neighborhoods, yet few are designated, and therefore they're not protected from demolition. So without either funding support or flexibility in the code, these buildings are not feasible to save as the city continues to experience pressure for added density. And another thing I wanted to mention that came out of the study is we realized that the city is not maintaining the most accurate records when it comes to URM buildings that are actually being upgraded. And this is problematic because it's important that we understand trends and policy impacts and what's working and what's not working. So on this particular priority, first we're asking council support and making these database updates a priority. And second, we would really like to convene a seismic task force to identify ways that we might balance the goals of life safety, neighborhood revitalization, and historic preservation. And these might include allowing historic URM buildings some code flexibility in the form of either phased upgrades, targeted upgrades that might focus on the most critical or dangerous aspects of these buildings, and or implementation of early detection system and training for occupants.
I think it's worth noting, too, I think our historic inventory of buildings is less than 5% of the whole city building inventory, so we're not talking about a large amount of, you know, population at risk relative to the investment we're talking about in some of these instances. And so I think just trying to find reasonable ways to both create, keep that livability and then make the best value investments where we can.
And do you have a general sense of those 5% and the ones that you looked at in these outer east areas, what proportion of them are worth saving?
That's a great question. The 5% are ones that actually would be designated historic. So okay. I would say those are all worth saving. Okay. Some of these are outside of that, actually, because they're not designated, and those are the ones actually that are at risk. So that might be a little bit of a misleading statistic in that regard, but I don't think it's a huge number, you know, just because these are small kind of hub-and-spoke commercial centers from when we had the streetcar system, essentially. So, yeah.
So moving on to priority four, which Brian touched on a bit, which is public agency cooperation. This is another one of our ongoing priorities, which is to maintain open lines of communication with our public agencies and to champion the stewardship of historic resources and public ownership. Brian mentioned that we had a positive meeting with Patrick Quinton and Ed McNamara earlier this year. And out of that came sort of the establishment of a liaison with PDC and ongoing quarterly meetings. So we feel very good about that. Brian served on the selection committee for the Grove Hotel in Chinatown, and so we feel like that is moving in a very positive direction. Mayor Hills, we were very happy to have the opportunity to tour with you last winter through the new and the old Blanchet houses and Fire Station 2.
The waterfall.
Right.
Of course, but we still have some ongoing concerns about some properties. We've got a watch list at the end of the report, and we still have Fire Station 2 and the old Blanchet in there. We understand that Fire Station 2, that there is some sort of RFP or RFQ process that's going to be happening, and so we're hoping that's going to move that property forward in a positive direction, and so we're cautiously optimistic and really hope that that property will be coming off our watch list in hopefully next year. What else was that? Oh, Centennial Mills is another one out there where we're cautiously optimistic. We understand that there's good positive forward momentum. It's not officially a designated historic resource, although I don't think anyone argues that it's a very important and unique historic resource for the city, but the Landmarks Commission hasn't really been included in any of those discussions with how that property is moving forward, and we would really like to be in the loop. So with respect to this priority, we're essentially just asking for your ongoing support, which you provided, to continue to help us maintain those good lines of communication with PDC and other public stewards of historic resources. Commissioner Fritz, Brian, and I would really appreciate the opportunity if we could come and have a meeting with you, given that we work with your staff, and I think it's great to have those one-on-one opportunities to talk about goals. And perhaps Mayor Hales, with some of the other items that have a BPS connection, that having a sit-down discussion as well on priorities would also be very helpful.
The only thing I'd add to that, too, is, you know, there used to be this requirement, or it was kind of a fantasy requirement because it never actually happened, but where someone would serve on the Planning and Sustainability Commission and the Landmarks Commission, and it was just too much of a demand, I think, to really get that fulfilled. So
hey, we have a shortage of masochists.
Yeah, exactly. So in lieu of that, we've been doing quarterly chair meetings between Bureau of Planning and the Planning and Sustainability Commission Chair, Landmarks Commission Chair, and the Design Commission Chair, Gwen, who's going to come up next. And so those have been really successful, I think, to make sure we're working in concert. This actually kind of came out of the design guidelines discussion in 2008, and so I think that that's just been a positive thing moving forward, and it's working. So I wanted to let you know that. So next, priority five, preserving neighborhoods. So this really kind of ties into, I know a lot of people are going to be here talking about demolition and that's been a hot item that's coming kind of to the top in the community recently. So we had this, you know, we had to have this report together several months ago. So it was already a concern at that point, just in terms of making sure we're not losing key fabric in our neighborhoods. And with, honestly, I think this is a great problem to have. It sounds funny to say that, but we've created this amazing livable city, and we've got density goals, and people want to be here. And so, you know, and we've got an economy that's really starting to drive the demand. And so we're starting to see some friction in some areas. So, and so I think, like all policy, there's kind of a back and forth dialogue that needs to happen, and maybe adjustments need to be made, you know, to make sure we're moving forward in a direction we want to go. So, but, you know, some of the things that we're looking at, and we've put together a white paper that we want to share with you. I don't want to dump this on you at the last minute, but we want to make sure we're basically being proactive and giving you guys at least some of our thoughts on this for your consideration. But just talking about how we might be able to reduce demolition in historic neighborhoods. And, you know, we've got, there's a couple of big areas that we're aware of, which are just kind of loopholes in the code, essentially, it seems like, where there's a demolition delay exception if you're going to replace one unit with one unit. But we've seen where, you know, some people are coming in with applications to replace one unit with one unit and get the demolition permit and then come back the next week and apply for the second or third unit. And similarly with, like, lot divisions as well. So it seems like some of those things might be fairly easily addressed from the code side of things. And then also just what we kind of call virtual demolitions, where you can tear down pretty much everything but a brick or a chimney and, you know, find that that isn't actually a demolition in terms of the official designation. So we're kind of thinking that maybe if we could, you know, ask for, if you're going to tear down more than 50% of the existing building, say, or something, you know, come up with some sort of a metric that defines what the demolition actually is in the code, that could be productive. And then, you know, finally just thinking about maybe establishing a task force where we can look at some of these issues in more detail, and we've got some suggestions in here, which are also in the report as well, but more specifics in here, so.
Have you had any discussions with the Development Review Advisory Committee?
No, we have not, so that might be a good group to get connected with next. So,
and I've asked the chair of that group to give a short presentation on this issue after you get done.
Excellent.
That'll be helpful to start that discussion.
Yeah, and I think, you know, and I don't know if you guys have seen, there's a great, doing more research on this as I'm getting emails and calls every day in the last few weeks, as you guys probably are as well. You know, there's a lot of information in this Bureau of Planning and Sustainability report that came out. I don't know if you guys have taken a look at this, but it's pretty recent, I think June 2014. But some of the things in there actually really surprised me in that, you know, for one, I guess it really is an issue we're finding, because 2013 set a record for demolitions of single-family residents, and we're already on track to eclipse that this year.
I actually had a question about that,
sure.
And then one other question on this page. I mean, you said that in 2013, the city received over 200 residential demolition permits.
Yeah.
And how many residences do we have in the city? It's over 100,000, isn't it?
About 150,000. Right?
That's a good question. Actually, the number is 283, I found out afterwards.
Dwelling units? Or
dwelling units, yeah, that's my understanding.
About 150,000 single-family houses, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So actually, I mean, looking at those numbers, it seemed to me that if we demolish 200 houses a year, we'd be replacing, we'd be on a 500-year replacement schedule for all of the houses. And that actually struck me as kind of surprisingly low, if anything.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Numerically speaking, I think that's right. I mean, the question is quantity, quality, not numerical, but you're right. On a numerical basis, you know, we are under the replacement rate, but we want to be. So that's, you know, that's part of the dilemma here.
Yeah, and I'm not saying all those homes either are historic or whatever, you know, so, but we've got, we have kind of that number, you know, which is now this year's trending up closer, I think, toward 400 units. So it's definitely a trend. And then we have these virtual demolitions that are not really tracked because those aren't part of that metric. But one of the things I thought that was surprising about the numbers when you look in the data from Bureau of Planning and Sustainability is that most of those, I assume they're all kind of density replacements for the most part, but really about 50% of them don't result in any increase in density. They're actually 1,100 square foot average house replaced with a 2,100 square foot average house. So you know, we're talking about actually, and if you look at the map, there are a lot of them are on the outlying areas of the city, and this may or may not be a preservation issue, but it starts to be an equity issue because, you know, the houses that are being taken out are more affordable and the ones going in are twice as big.
Mm-hmm. The other question I had on this page is you suggest introducing residential design guidelines that promote the use of high-quality design materials when replacing a landmark or contributing structure. What's a contributing structure?
I'll let you speak to that, Jessica, because you're there.
Certainly. So when we're talking about historic districts, buildings are designated as contributing or non-contributing. They're not individually listed as landmarks or as National Register buildings, but the district as a whole is the resource, and then we define buildings. If they're contributing, that means they have historic significance, and we're placing a higher priority on their preservation.
So that's only in the historic districts themselves?
I believe that. I'm not quite sure the exact context of what we're talking about, but when we formally talk about contributing in the world of preservation, we are talking about districts.
Okay, so if you're outside an historic district, a building wouldn't be a contributing building.
Correct, yeah. We have this kind of weird overlap, though, with, like, say, Canton. That's a conservation district.
Right, we do have conservation districts.
It doesn't have the same level of protections, so and those were kind of... The idea with the conservation districts, in my understanding, was that they were kind of targeted to be historic districts, and then we had this owner consent ruling from the state in the mid-90s that kind of put the kibosh on new historic landmarks being designated or new historic districts without owner consent. So those kind of were left in this in-between kind of stasis.
One more question that I was forgetting, which is, you suggest introducing a public process that allows for review and delay of demolition of a structure greater than 75 years old until the updated HRI is complete. Does that mean that there should be some delay, or that you mean that there be a delay until after the updated HRI is complete? So if that takes 3 years, then it should be a three-year delay.
No, I think some delay, not a indefinite delay until the HRI is updated. So,
and what's the what's the value of delay? Unless at some point there's actually the ability to stop something?
I think that's a great question. And I think that what we've seen is that the value of the delay, there's a couple of areas. I mean, one is allows for a neighborhood dialogue and important high-profile properties. Two, you know, recently in Northwest Portland that were kind of all over, the Goldsmith House and the so-called Google House. They didn't have a delay in place, but there was able to be a kind of a coalition kind of ad hoc put together to try to come up with some alternative options, and actually resolutions were found in those cases. But in this case of the Goldsmith House, you know, they paid $700,000 over what the original developer bought that house for. So it's kind of almost like a ransom sort of a deal. And frankly, you know, those kinds of solutions aren't going to work in our outer neighborhoods where we just don't have those kind of resources. And so I think the demolition delay allows for a dialogue, but it also allows to level the playing field, I think, when we're talking about a lot of the properties possibly being targeted by sophisticated developers that have cash, because a cash close is more appealing to a seller than a 30 to 60 day bank financed mortgage. And so it gives kind of first right of refusal essentially to the neighborhood if someone's going to come in and buy the house and reuse it as a house, or if the neighbors want to gather together and if it's important enough, then they have that opportunity, because there's maybe a 120-day delay if it's going to be demolished. So it kind of levels out the buying playing field. But if it doesn't come forward, then it is a good opportunity for added density or a new dwelling.
Thank you.
I'd say, you know, a couple other things in the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability report that were interesting too is, you know, back on the density, only 8% of the demolitions actually accounted for 80% of the number of units that were the replacement units. So in some areas, you know, we're getting a lot of bang for our buck in terms of our density goals, but in other areas, it's kind of a onesie twosie thing. And it's, you know, it might be a great old house on a corner lot and we replace it with two skinny houses. And so just trying to maybe think about where our density is zoned for and getting a little more targeted possibly. And again, our interest is in the historic neighborhoods and protecting the integrity of those. And then understanding that we do need to meet our density goals in the bigger picture, and where are we getting the best value out of that. And, you know, from a sustainability standpoint, I think it's important to realize, too, that, you know, the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability report showed that 40 million pounds of waste were created just by those homes, which is 5% of all of the waste in the entire city for that year, which is pretty alarming. And it takes about 50 years to replace the carbon footprint of building a new super energy efficient home. And that's not counting the embodied resources that you're losing from what's there. And then when we know that the new homes are twice as big, it's kind of an equation where how much more energy efficient really are they when they're twice as big. So some of those statistics I think are good to look at, and you know, we'd like to share the white paper with you guys and obviously have you guys contemplate that a little bit. But.
Well, I just want to say I really appreciate not just your service on the commission, but this really thoughtful and clear-eyed counsel that you give us and to the community. I mean, particularly timely this year because there have been some pretty controversial and high-profile cases of demolition. But I think that both your report and your recommendations in the white paper, I'm looking forward to reading that, are, you know, I think really timely and helpful. So I just want to commend and thank you and the other members of the commission. As Commissioner Fritz said, you're volunteers. You are masochists, but for a good purpose. But we appreciate you very much. You know, look forward to the larger discussion here that we're going to have about demolition in particular. I just want you to know from my standpoint, on the list of key buildings, that we are really committed in my office to make sure that those buildings that are under the supervision of PDC do get out there for RFP, get creative ideas for how to reuse them. If there's, you know, there's one thing going for us right now is a much better development economy. Well, if there was ever a time when a great old building that wasn't financially feasible before to have a second chance, it's about now. So some of these buildings are difficult. You know, the engine number 2 is a difficult project.
Yeah. Yes.
Lord knows Centennial Mills is a difficult project. But if there was ever a time in which we could probably get over the hump and make it happen with a focused effort on PDC's part, I think that's now. So appreciate you highlighting those and keeping the pressure on me and on PDC and Patrick and the PDC board to get going with these projects. So don't hold back.
Right. Thank you. Yes.
Were you planning to go through that list, or is your presentation?
Sure. We can run through that quickly if you like.
Yeah, it would be a good idea.
You want to walk through that, Jessica? Or?
And the first one's a district. But.
Right. So yeah. I think Brian touched on enough the issues we have with Chinatown and the importance of those design guidelines. And that's why we put that on the watch list, is the design guidelines are going to be really critical to making sure that that district kind of remains with enough integrity.
Again, we're excited about these opportunities. We just want to make sure that we're also thinking about them. You know,
right. This is a list that's there to help raise awareness for sure. The original Blanchet House, again, you know, this is another one where we realize how difficult it is that this is a challenging building on a challenging site at the end of the district, but it's another one of those where in Chinatown, we really want to avoid, if at all possible, the sort of chipping away at the edges of the district and the buildings that kind of make up the cultural fabric of this district. Chinatown is more of a cultural district than it is one that is significant for its architecture. I think we've talked enough about the firehouse. Portland Public Schools, we recently had a briefing from Portland Public Schools as they're going through this modernization project, and we're really encouraging them that although their schools, there are very few buildings that are actually designated and therefore require any sort of land use review, we're really encouraging PPS to come before the Landmarks Commission and seek our guidance on an advisory basis. They have an amazing collection of significant historic buildings that are often sort of that center landmark piece of our neighborhoods. And as they're considering modernization projects, which we're very thrilled that are sometimes peeling off additions that were done in a very not very sensitive manner, that we want to encourage them that as they are putting back more modern additions, that they are compatible with the historic resource in the neighborhood.
Yeah, one thing on that, I mean, they're the largest public property owner in the city, as far as I understand. And it's tough with these not-for-profit historic property owners because they can't take advantage of tax credits or other tools that a lot of private development uses. So there's not a lot of incentive for, say, well, that's listed on the National Register, even though they're eligible. So yeah, just having that dialogue with them, I think, is important.
And you don't think there is much one at the moment?
We have had some dialogue with them. I would say what they did, and Jessica, you can probably talk more about this because it relates to historic listing, but basically they did a historic survey with a consultant and really studied all the resources they have at the request of the Landmarks Commission, and then they entered into a voluntary pact with the State Historic Preservation Office for kind of a non-binding advisory review when they do this work. So the one you see there where it says Roosevelt High School proposed addition rendering, they showed that to the State Historic Preservation Office. That would probably never fly at the Landmarks Commission level. And the state, when we spoke with them in follow-up, acknowledged that really they don't have any leverage to actually make them do much of anything as far as changes. It's just they need to come and inform them of what they're doing and have a talk, but it's not a binding kind of consideration like it would be if they were coming for design review at the Landmarks Commission level. So I would say, you know, they're definitely interested in making steps forward and wanting to be responsible property owners, but just haven't gone to that next level, possibly, of just, even if it's voluntary, coming to the Landmarks Commission and having that talk.
Perhaps we could have some high-level discussions, because I'm certainly share your opinion that maybe the whole behind the facade goes away, but the historic facades of Franklin and Roosevelt in particular would be a huge loss to the neighborhood if they were to change into something else.
Yeah, and I'd say to be clear, too, they're definitely being good stewards about the original historic resource. We're a little more concerned about the non-compatible, in our mind, additions to the resource where, you know, they came and presented the, oh, this is the horrible 50s add-on, you know, we're getting rid of this, and then here's what we're going to put up. And, you know, it's like, oh
right.
Well, it looks kind of similar to what was there. So, you know, and just making sure that we feel like, well, yeah, okay, that it doesn't need to be identical to it, but it feels compatible with the original resource. We're not making the same possible mistake again.
Mm-hmm. Well, please let the mayor know if you need his assistance in that.
I think you've got it on that score.
All right. I mean, these are...
And when you need him.
Yeah, right.
Definitely.
Conversation's going to happen.
These are some of the most important, because they're kind of de facto parks in our neighborhoods, too, but we just don't have control over them, which is interesting. So, yeah.
So Multnomah County Courthouse, we included on the list here that we, you know, we understand there's plans for a new courthouse, and we want to raise awareness of the fact that this is a really important resource and that we recognize it's going to be, you know, it's a big building and it's going to be a tough one to reuse. But we want to get eyes and ears out there that this is going to be important to the commission, that we find a creative way to reuse that building when the time comes. And then Centennial Mills, we've already touched on again. Very unique and important resource, one that we recognize is more of an adaptive reuse project than any sort of a project that is going to sort of preserve a building that was a very utilitarian use that had many structures that never even had human beings in them, that it was just grain. And so we recognize that there would need to be some flexibility. We would just really love to hear what the plans are and be able to offer some feedback to the developer as they move forward. And we have two on the backside here. So you are probably aware that the Portland Gas and Coke has been in the media off and on, that there's a group of advocates that are really looking at this building. It's a historically significant building with a lot of challenges, environmental challenges in particular, and some costly stabilization strategies. But it's another one where it would be a shame to be lost. And so we've included that on our watch list, as well as the Morris Marks House, which is located at the southern end of downtown, with zoning that allows for very tall buildings there, placing a lot of development pressure on a building that is one of our foremost examples of Italianate residential architecture. And again, another one that we want to keep our eyes on.
Yeah, even if it's relocated or something. I mean,
absolutely.
I think we recognize that some of these sites are going to develop, but needing to find homes takes a while. So, and that's kind of part of that demolition delay, too, is being able to have that dialogue. So,
terrific. Thank you very much
Thank
for
you
all
very
of your
much.
Work and for this presentation.
Thank you so much for having us. We really appreciate the audience. So.
Thank you.
Now, the next I'd like to call up Jeff Fish, the chairman of the Development Review Advisory Committee, also known as DRAC, which is a balanced group of community stakeholders that advises the Bureau of Development Services, and they have been addressing the issue of demolitions. And so I just wanted Jeff to give an overview of where they are in that process.
Thank you. A couple things before I start out. I want to remind people that the demolitions that make the paper are the nice, really nice, pretty much nice homes in some pretty nice neighborhoods. on the other side of that issue, you can go out some areas of town where we're taking down stuff that is almost falling down, has no economic value. So people need to remember to balance those two items out. And mentioned in the report and also mentioned in the media is the epidemic of demolitions. It was touched on a little bit by the previous speakers, but to give an example, in 2006 we had 270 demolitions, and in 2005 we had 265 demolitions. They fell off quite a bit during the recession, and now we're back up to that number and probably will be over 300 at some point. Yesterday staff told me possibly around 350 they thought for this year. That's not an epidemic, as was pointed out earlier, where in your discussions, where out of 150,000, 200,000 structures in the city, we're replacing them all in 500 years maybe. So I wanted to point those out. What DRAC is doing is we embarked on a couple of directions with demolitions. July 1st, we embarked on a door hanger notice that when a house is being demolished, we're voluntarily asking the builders to go out and hang door knockers on each side of the property, across the street, and the properties behind. We're doing it as a voluntary situation right now, kind of tracking that. We didn't want to put it in code and find out that it wasn't working or it wasn't structured right and have a tough time getting it back out of code. But at some point in time, I think we will put it into code. I think the one time is probably a little bit back up. It's only been a month, so BDS doesn't have statistics yet, but it played a part, as I understand it, in the preservation of the house, or at least the discussions between the Eastmoreland Neighborhood Association and Renaissance Development on 36th and Rural. And going forward, the other two main issues that the public has brought up is the issue of asbestos and the issue of preservation of the nicer homes. On the we're having some meetings. We had a meeting. Let me add one other thing. The definition of remodel and demolition. We had a meeting on Tuesday with about five members of DRAC, four or five members of DRAC, and about 10 members of staff to try to get to that definition. We spent an hour and a half. We're going to have some other meetings. One of them is going to be on that item, and we're going to break off on the second I'm going to talk about. It's really tough to get into a definition of major remodel and demolition. We spent an hour and a half between about 15 of us working on that. Mm-hmm. It takes into account in that definition non-conforming uses. It takes in other zoning questions. It takes in SDC fees. It takes in street improvements. And so it involves more than one bureau. And we're having a tough time wrestling with that. A month or so ago, I had a friendly conversation with Tom Kelly, president of Neil Kelly Company, who's been in the business his whole life, and he can't give me a good definition of remodel and demolition. So BDS staff's working on that. We'll come to some point on that.
Jeff, am I understanding correctly that there's some state regulation in the building code that relates to the whole, is it a partial demolition or a full demolition?
I believe so, but I'm not one to answer that. I don't do much remodeling, so almost no remodeling, so that's something outside of what I could answer for you. Staff, I'm sure, could. Moving forward on DRAC, we want to tackle the issue of asbestos. That's been a big one with the neighbors. I presented some information to the DRAC subcommittee on Tuesday. One of those things is a 8-point check sheet that City of Hillsborough uses. First item on it is asbestos. There's a $10,000 per day fine for being out of compliance with the DEQ rules. My feeling is that doesn't scare a builder developer. Nothing's going to scare a builder developer. I think in a couple of the potential asbestos problems that we've had may have been people that weren't educated correctly on that. Home builders have been talking to DEQ also about putting on some programs to educate the building industry a little bit more about asbestos. But we want to put together something that addresses that pretty much sets it up so that we get the majority of the people doing it right. Is there going to be a bad builder doing it wrong? Yeah. Is there other bad people do things wrong? We all know that. But we're going to try to address that. Second item is preservation of those properties that probably ought to be preserved. It's my thinking, and I presented this to the group, that with the historic resource inventory list, in the bottom tier of that list, which is just a letter to get on, a letter to get off, that in 84 had about 5,000 properties on. I don't know how many are on there now. I'm thinking of putting some teeth into that, and what I would like to do is update that list, let the people who want to be on it stay on it, those who want to come off it, but record it against the property. And then when a demo permit is issued, a period of time, say at least 60 days, be given for the neighborhood association to deal with the seller to see if they want to buy that person out of that property, similar as what's, as I understand, is happening on the 36th and Rural property. And then add a couple of maybe two 30-days extension or a 60-day extension for a total of 120 days, which would each equal the current 120-day delay we have, and maybe charge a fee for that extension so there's some skin in the process. And I'm not against giving that fee back if the sale goes through. What the building committee doesn't like is a 120-day delay that nothing happens. It just sits on the sideline. Nobody's even talking to each other. So I'm trying to run that through DRAC, see what they want to do. We've had good communications. Mary Helen Kincaid, Vice Chair of DRAC, put together a meeting with myself, Justin Wood from the Home Builder Association, Ann Dufay, and Robert McCulloch from Eastmoreland and from Southeast Uplift. And we sat down over lunch and talked about the issue. Robert asked me to speak to Southeast Uplift, which I did. He asked to come speak to DRAC. We had him come speak to DRAC, which I think is the only time we've had an outside speaker that wasn't part of city government come speak at DRAC. And then Robert and I had lunch separately to discuss the issue. Mary Helen Kincaid and Claire Carter, who are the two neighborhood representatives on DRAC, we've had a couple, at least one or two meetings among ourselves where we sit down and talk about the issue. So DRAC's moving forward on this. We think we can tackle the issue. We think we can come to something that we can bring before city council, there will be a working situation. We have, I feel, have breached the continuing builder neighborhood problem that I've seen my whole career, that you and I've been at auger's heads before. I think we've breached that, and we have a good communication level, and I want to see that continue on. And so I'm hoping that DRAC will be allowed to deal with this. If the historic people wrote the historic report want to sit down with us and go through it, I think we have a good approach, and we're working on a good approach moving forward.
And what's your timeline that you think that DRAC might be able to come to some consensus and move something to me and to council?
It sounds like a long time, but I want to do it by the end of the year, partly because I roll off my term at DRAC on January. Part of our problem this summer has been getting together and having a meeting because of city staff being on vacation and occasionally some DRAC members on vacation, but it's been more city staff on vacation that were important parts of sitting in on that. I'm thinking once we get through August that maybe we can make some ground up fairly quick. We're Nancy Thorington, who's kind of chairing the meetings, a BDS employee. We emailed back and forth yesterday. She's looking at towards the end of the month trying to get us together again into August. So hopefully we get that done fairly soon.
So 6 months rather than a year or 2 years.
My term's up on DRAC in January. I'd like to have this taken care of. I don't mind being the person in the crosshairs, both for the building industry and for the neighborhood associations, if we can get to something that works.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, appreciate your service, Jeff. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Beth.
So I realize that folks often, having been sitting in the audience myself waiting to testify, that that's often the case. I want to point out the distinction that today we're hearing from citizens who are likewise volunteers and here on their own time. So that's why we'd like to move to the Design Commission's report now, so that because many of the issues that we've heard about are not only historic resource issues but also design review. So if you could
please go, if you would, call, let's recess.